The visionary world of architect Jan Kaplicki is captured in the hugely impressive new coffee table book Jan Kaplicki, Pro budoucnost a pro krásu, for the future and for beauty. The hefty monograph is the fruit of 10 years of work by his friend Ivan Margolius, himself also a Prague-born architect who made a life and career in the UK. It traces his beginnings in Czechoslovakia, the story of the highly progressive Future System studio, and the realization of some of Kaplicki's space-age designs, alongside interviews with many of his closest associates. I discuss the late architect's evolution, relationship to his native country, and much more with Ivan Margolius. When did Kaplicki begin to develop what became his distinctive style?
Well, he worked at for Norman Foster, and there he met his future partner, David Nixon. Both of them at that time, which was early 70s, mid-70s, were very keen on sort of technological spacecraft projects. I mean, they were keen to bring into architecture technologies, you know, like aircraft design or spacecraft design or automobile design, which very rarely in those days happened because architecture was rather blinkered. So they started working the sort of high tech, as it's called, high tech principles, and both were very keen on it. And it's, you know, it's obviously in those first projects, even in the some of the work Jan has done in Prague, that this was quite successful. Only in sort of mid-1980s, suddenly Jan decided to look at organic inspiration for his architecture, and his architecture became a sort of blobby architecture, as it's called nowadays. And that all started with, as it's called, the blob building on Trafalgar Square, which was a competition project which Jan hasn't entered into, which was like a sort of organic shape sitting on the corner of a building. And it was quite shocking because no one's seen a building of that form before.
And did his style evolve as technology changed?
Well, initially, as I said, it was based on the sort of technology aspects of inspirational trends, but from the mid-80s it was organic shapes, it was seashells, it was mushrooms, it was flowers, plants. So he suddenly went for the inspiration in nature, and I think it was partly influenced by his mother, because his mother was a very well-known illustrator of plants, and she published quite a lot of about 10, 12 books where she illustrated plants of various nature, cacti and flowers and orchids. And I think Jan, because his mother died in 1984, and I believe he suddenly realized the value of his mother's work, and he got interested in that kind of inspiration. Eva Jiříčná was telling me the story. Initially, when they lived together in the high-tech days, when Jan was doing his high-tech architecture, Jiříčná was sitting in, they lived together, and she sat in his flat, watching David Attenborough's nature programs. And Jan was saying to her, "Why are you watching this? What's, you know, there's nothing interesting about that sort of program." It's quite revealing that 10 years later, he suddenly does a total U-turn and starts being interested in the same sort of forms.
What would you say was his greatest project, either realized or unrealized?
From my point of view, I like the Lourdes Media Centre because it's so sort of unique and so startling, and it looks like a spacecraft landing in London suddenly. It was inspired by a SLR camera, which is looking onto the cricket field and observing what's going on. And in a way, the building design finally looks very much like it. And it was made by a boatyard in Cornwall. So the building itself is not built by conventional means. It's an aluminium semi-monocoque shell. And there was no contractor in Britain, normal standard contractor, who could build that building. So Jan and Amanda went to a boat show in Earl's Court or wherever it was, and they found a boatyard contractor who actually built the building. So it's very unique in its form here.
And don't you say also in the book that that building, the Lords Media Centre, was partly inspired by the Kralovský letohrádek, I forget the English name, in Prague?
Yes, I think the roof of the building has got that sort of boat-like shape. The Belvedere, I think it's called, isn't it? So that was one of the inspirations as well. But the first sketch of the building was on a flight, I think, from London to Prague, and he sketched on a little serviette.
Was he frustrated that more of his designs weren't realized?
Well, of course. The problem with Jan was that he wasn't a businessman. He was a genius designer, but he lacked this sort of business acumen which Amanda had. So they perfectly complemented each other. She was on the sort of business side of the practice, and he was the designer, because if he didn't get together with Amanda, I don't think none of the buildings he designed would have been put up. So she brought this sort of business experience and looking after the construction of buildings, trying to get clients who would be interested in the project, in Jan's designs, and bringing them into the practice. And that was a great achievement on her part. So it was a very good partnership they had together, which then culminated in getting the Sterling Prize in 1999 for the Lords Media Centre, for example.
I don't want to get too much into the story of his design for the National Library building at Letná here in Prague, which, despite him winning an international competition, was blocked by the authorities. But there's one fascinating aspect in your book, and that's the suggestion that around that time, he was named the most charming Czech man of the year in a magazine. And you suggest this may have worked against him in connection with that project.
Well, yes. I mean, there were difficult times then. As we know, Václav Klaus was the president in those days. And it was very sad that even him... he decided to, you know, that he didn't like the project. The other aspect was Pavel Bem, who was actually on the jury of the competition, and he agreed that Kaplitsky Future Systems design was the best design, and he approved, you know, that as being the chosen best design. But then he turned around and being persuaded, as it's believed by other politicians, by Václav Klaus and maybe Knížák from the gallery, modern gallery.
But do you believe that Klaus, Knížák and Bem were jealous of the fact that Kaplitsky was named the most charming man of the year in a magazine?
Yes, I mean, that was one of the factors that suddenly, you know, they were rather narcissistic personalities, especially Václav Klaus. It's interesting that in 2004, we went to a Czech embassy together with Jan for a celebration, and Václav Klaus was there visiting the embassy. Klaus was giving away his photographs, signed photographs, and Jan went to him and had a photograph signed by him because he wanted one for his son Josef for a collection. And I think they chatted quite amiably at that time. And then, you know, 4 years later, 3 years later, they, you know, became enemies. And I think that article probably played a big role in the whole sort of breakup of that relationship, if ever there was a relationship.
That's amazing. Generally speaking, what was Kaplitsky's relationship to the Czech Republic after 89?
We met quite often, you know, at least once a month. And we discussed, you know, politics, we discussed the cultural events, both in Britain and the Czech Republic. And Jan had enormous interest, obviously, with his native country, and he wanted desperately to build something there. And it was such a joy when the library came along and he actually managed to achieve such a great success there. But when, you know, as soon as we sat down together and celebrated, I was warning him that it's going to be difficult because, you know, he's going to be perceived as a sort of escaped foreigner coming back to Prague. And a lot of people will feel they're being upstaged, that, you know, then he sort of took the easy route by escaping the difficulties when the Russians came, and then now coming back and trying to take their work away, their projects away. We were discussing it for hours, and I warned him that it's going to be very difficult.
I interviewed him, I don't know, about 2004 or something like that. He was very polite, very nice guy, but I had a sense that he had a kind of air of sadness about him. What was he really like at the personal level?
Well, he had that sort of pessimistic outlook, which is not surprising with all these difficulties he's lived through. And that was his nature. And I think a lot of his friends, and as you can see in the book, everyone noticed the same sort of trait in him. And it's rather peculiar that he produced these very optimistic buildings. There is very much looking forward into the future on one hand, and then have a personality where he was very sort of pessimistic and down looking, and one had to cheer him up every time one met him to make sure that he survives the next day.
I also got the impression from the book that he was a man who very much wanted to create his own world, or who had created his own world. He even had strong ideas about what his romantic partners should wear.
Yes, I think, you know, it's like Adolf Loos, who similarly worked like that, dictated all what his clients should wear, what furniture they should buy, what pictures should they have, what carpets they have, you know, what color walls. And architects sometimes go to extremes because they see whatever they design as their own. And by seeing it as their own, they dictate exactly what they want to see in that building or in that house. And it's very difficult for some clients to obviously to accept it. And I understand it's not fair on architects to demand these things. But if you build a house for a client, you're building it for the other person, not for yourself. But you know, some architects are so strong with their ideas, they feel offended if suddenly the client puts a frilly curtains in their windows. I mean, that building, for example, in Wales, that wonderful residential little cottage, in a way, one would say, built into a hillside, just like an eye looking onto the sea. Jan designed like he was designing it for himself. And the client complained to him there are a lot of impractical things there. There weren't, for example, any drawers in the kitchen cabinets. So the lady client was saying, you know, where she was taking over the building, you know, where do I put my cutlery and things like that? There's no storage in the building because it would be sort of, you know, putting a storage cupboard there. It wouldn't look nice. So Jan had that very sort of stubborn idea sometimes, and he didn't like to listen too much to any criticism or other ideas. He had very strong vision, and that's what he wanted to keep to all the time.
My final question is it possible to speak about a legacy of Jan Kaplicki?
Well, absolutely. I mean, he was a great favorite of every student of architecture. Wherever Jan had a lecture, the halls were packed, and a lot of people imitated his ideas. I mean, for example, the Gherkin building in London, designed by Ken Shuttleworth when he worked for Foster's, is very much like the Greenbird building, which Jan designed, you know, 4 or 5 years earlier, for example. or the City Hall of the GLC building, this new City Hall by the Tower Bridge. Again, that's based most probably on the Blob building. So there are a lot of examples where Jan's work is very inspirational for other architects, which is wonderful, really. So the legacy is there, and it's ongoing, and it will go on.